Okay, I'm going to call to order this August 18th, 2016 meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. Welcome, everyone. We have, I think, a really interesting agenda ahead of us today. We're going to start off talking about the issue of court fines and fees, get a better understanding of how they work. The variety of them. We're then going to talk about certificates of good standing, or whatever we want to call them, and we have the good justice here to talk to us about that. And we're also going to then be on the phone with people from Washington State who have recently passed legislation around what they call certificates of restoration of opportunity. We'll hear how that program works and to what extent we can learn from that. And then we will also be hearing from them about their recently enacted driver's license suspension reform legislation to hear what led to that, what it involves, and how it's going. Then under discussion of next steps, there are a couple of other issues that have arisen that I want to talk to you about. So before we get started, though, I just want to go around the table in the room, see who's here and who's on the phone. I'm the task force chair, Michael Dembro, and I chair the Senate's Committee on Workforce and represent Northeast and Southeast Portland in the Oregon Senate.
I'm Lou Frederick. I'm state representative for District 43. That's North and Northeast Portland, next door. And I am on the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee, General Government Committee, I'm on the education, vice chair of the education committee, and there's another one that I'm now for some reason forgetting.
Yeah. But it's okay. It's all going to change.
It's all going to change. That's true. That's true. But I am I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I'm Paul Solomon. I'm the executive director at Sponsors Reentry Program in Lane County and the chair of Lane County's Public Safety Coordinating Council.
I'm Jen Netherwood. I'm a journey-level carpenter, and I'm an instructor and outreach specialist at the Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute.
My name is Brian Jed. I'm the Reentry Transition Center Program Manager for Mercy Corps Northwest in Portland.
And I'm Truls Neal, Deputy Director with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, also representing the Oregon Community Corrections Directors.
Great. I'm Cheyenne Ronson. This is Sam Pittman and your staff.
Hi.
Chad Morgan from Public Affairs Council here representing Lynn County.
Great, welcome.
Anne O'Malley, I'm here for Mercy Corps Northwest Reentry Transition Center.
Thanks, Sam.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sharon Azar. I'm actually a physician working in Portland, Oregon, who's just interested in reentry. And I know that health doesn't fall underneath this task force umbrella, but I just wanted to come and learn what's happening in the state.
Mm-hmm. I'm Kachetta Swessinger. I'm trial team leader over at Marion County District Attorney's Office in the Child Support Enforcement Unit. My office is here briefly today at request of Commissioner Carlson to talk a little bit about the family aspect of reentry and some of the challenges about that.
Great.
I'm Jeanine Giesner. I'm the Deputy District Attorney with Marion County.
I'm Mari Fleur, investigator with the Marion County DA's office as well. In the Child Support Division.
Great.
I'm Taylor Smiley Wolf with TI Codec's office.
I'm Paul DeMunis, a retired private citizen.
Bill Lemon, I'm your first witness.
Great. Okay, great. Okay, well, why don't we get started then? Oh, right. That's right. Sorry. On the phone we have Rep Parrish.
Deborah MC with Multifamily Northwest.
Hey, Deborah. Great.
Hi, this is Eddie Alice, Treasure Valley Community College.
Okay, Eddie.
Mike Schmidt for the Criminal Justice Commission, on the road between Bend and Portland. So if I drop off, I'll try to get back on.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mike.
Jim Booker from Oregon Employment Department in sunny San Francisco.
Poor you. Okay, great. Thanks, Jim.
Stephanie Sams from Washington State Department of Licensing.
Oh, yeah, thanks. We're so happy you're doing this. Thank you very much, Stephanie.
Sure, not a problem. I'll be accompanied with Clark Holloway. He's just not in the room right now.
Okay, great. All right. So let's start off with the discussion of court fines and fees, and we'll hear from Phil Lemon and Conchetta. Is this the area you were going to talk about?
It's not pertaining to fees. It's pertaining to child support, so the payment of child support, that someone owes when they get out sometimes.
Okay, well, we may have some questions for you relative to this subject, but Phil, would you come up and, yeah. So just before you start, it'll be no surprise to you that, you know, fees and fines have been identified as one of the barriers to reentry, offenders, once they're released and are trying to start over their lives, have, you know, the burden of fees and fines that were assessed at the time of their sentencing, but then actually in many cases will grow over time to become very difficult barriers to them. And the challenge is, how do we balance the need for those fines, for restitution, for other kinds of fees that are assessed, I mean, you know, many of them necessary, but how do we balance that against this situation of their being borne by people who don't have and will probably never have the ability to pay them? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the task force. I'm Phil Lemon from the Oregon Judicial Department, your state courts. And I would just like to say that this is the first time I've ever gone before Justice DeMunis, so I'm not sure that that's really appropriate, but thank you for the privilege. I prepared a brief PowerPoint to kind of walk you through some highlights, and then I'd be glad to answer your questions as best I can. So the state courts adjudicate all types of offenses, felonies, misdemeanors, and violations. Violations are things like traffic tickets for which there is no jail time involved, but always or most often involves a fine. And so all those, I mean, nobody comes in generally with just one issue. A felony case can also involve a misdemeanor. They can also have violation cases. The rules for all these things, both the imposition and collection and the ability of a court to substitute penalties and move things around, varies because the statutes that you write and approve set it up that way. So my understanding is you wanted to look at the post-prison group, and so I'm going to give you a brief overview, and then we'll focus on that population. But if you have other questions, I'll certainly try to answer them for you. So state courts handle about 500,000 cases a year. That includes civil cases. But included in that are about 30,000 felonies, 50 or 60,000 misdemeanors, and 200,000 violations. So that's a huge number of cases that involve financial obligations for law violations that come through the courts. The statutes, various statutes, either authorize or require courts to impose different kinds of financial obligations and then govern how they can be collected. So I'm going to use the term financial obligations because fines is one portion of that, but it's not the only and sometimes not the largest or the most difficult to collect or to forgive. Judgments issued by the court are valid for 20 years, and if there's restitution involved, they can go to 50 years. And so one reason courts have a lot of outstanding liquidated and delinquent debt to collect is because of the longevity of those obligations. And then, as you know, there are other financial obligations that are not directly related to the specific criminal proceeding but can come into play, such as child support, driver's license suspension and reinstatement fees, parole and probation supervision fees, as well as the cost of incarceration that can be collected from offenders. And then I would also Cheyenne, do they have the one pager you got that shows ability to pay, or did that you got from the public defender's office in Portland?
Mr. Chair, members of the task force, the Multnomah County Public Defender's Office has a little cheat sheet. We uploaded it to OLIS. Had to make some alterations to it, so it is available if you've got a laptop in front of you. But I can have copies printed.
The only reason I
distribute if you want to refer to it, it is available.
The only reason I bring that up is some statutes direct the court to consider ability to pay when imposing a financial obligation. Others, courts do not consider that. And so that I just thought was a good summary of the types of financial obligations and whether ability to pay is a consideration under the statute.
And Phil, are those sort of accidents of drafting or of legislative history, or is there a pattern there?
The courts never assume that anything the legislature does is an accident of drafting. I don't know. There's numerous statutes that come into play. I think sometimes the legislature wants to make sure that discussion is had, and other times, whether it's purposeful or inadvertent, I couldn't tell you. So some background. Since 1988, state courts have imposed about $4 billion in fines, and that is just the statutory fine that we're talking about.
Wow.
We've collected about, and that's 15.4 million cases. We've collected about 2.3 billion in about 14 million cases. And so what's left is about $1.5 billion, and you get an annual report from LFO talking about the outstanding liquidated and delinquent debt that the Judicial Department and other state entities have. And so that's the big number that we have. That represents, of that $1.5 billion, almost $900 million is from felony cases. And so those generally are the ones that have the largest financial obligations attached to them. Of that $875 million, about a third, nearly $500 million, is owed to crime victims. And that's an important distinction because the courts are not allowed to consider ability to pay in setting compensatory fines and restitution orders. In addition, the Oregon Constitution gives crime victims the constitutional right to prompt payment of restitution. And so because that's such a large chunk of money, that is, I think, largely untouchable in this discussion. There may be some things that we can talk about a little later, but I think just for your overall approach, you have to kind of consider that that's off the table. And then 90% of our cases are paid in full, so I think we do a pretty good job collecting. We always have room to improve, but that number is large in part because we deal with so many cases. The older cases get, the more difficult they are, and then the felony population is the lowest collection rate that we have. It's about 33% of those outstanding cases. Right now, we have about 137,000 cases in collections, and about 24,000 of those have multiple cases attached to them. So whether it's multiple felonies or a felony and a violation or whatever, these people don't come in with just one issue. And that, of course, makes your job to unravel this a little more difficult. So the types of obligations, we have victim compensation as a general category. Compensatory fines have the top priority, and then restitution is another one. The fine for felonies, the statute requires a $200 minimum fine, and then a maximum, depending on what the offense is, can be up to $125,000 to $500,000. And I would just add that courts generally do not impose anywhere near the maximum fine in these cases. There's a mandatory state assessment that is added on that goes to fund police training, child abuse review activities, and a number of things. It goes to the criminal fines account, and then the legislature allocates it from there. The court can impose costs, including recovering the court-appointed attorney costs if there's extradition involved. Statutes authorize courts to do that. Collection fees. If a person is sentenced for a felony and is not able to pay in full at the time of sentencing, they can be put on a payment plan. And so when there's a payment plan, there's a statutory fee that we are required to impose, and that gets added on. If we have to refer the case for collection, if it goes delinquent and refer it to a collection to a third-party collector, whether that's the Department of Revenue or a private collection firm, there's an additional fee that is imposed, again, required to be imposed. Interest is authorized under the statute. We have been waiving that for quite some time because we do not have an automated system that allows us to calculate that. And as you can imagine, with 137,000 delinquent cases, that's an enormous amount of work if we do that manually. So we have been waiving that requirement for many years. We do have a new case management system, and we are looking at its ability to automate that process, but that is, again, a work in process and is not on the immediate horizon. Then finally, there are supervision and jail fees. These are not imposed by the court, but they are statutorily authorized. And when you have somebody who's either on probation supervision or post-prison supervision, that becomes a part of this calculation as well. Yes, sir.
So with the court-imposed fees at sentencing, if a person isn't able to pay at sentencing, at what point do they become delinquent? If a person is sent to prison as a result of the adjudication, is it after they're released from prison if they don't make payment?
It would be 45 days after they have I'll just walk you through chronologically. If you're sentenced to prison and the court imposes a financial obligation, then all collection activities and any interest that could be imposed is suspended while that person's incarcerated. Then when they are released from prison, either through the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision or by the court, that's when they need to be on a payment plan if they're or paid the obligations. If that is not done, if they're on a payment plan and they go delinquent for 45 days, that's when our regular collections process kicks in.
And who establishes the payment plan?
Board of Parole. It's kind of a dual system. Mm-hmm. When the court has the authority and the responsibility to collect on that, the board's rules direct it as part of a condition of probation to collect those court-ordered obligations and to set up a payment plan and send that schedule of payments to the sentencing court. So, to be real honest, I don't know. I couldn't tell you how the process works in every judicial district in the state, but there's supposed to be a meeting of the minds there, and if the board has imposed a schedule and the offender's current on that, then I think the court would accept that. And it's not until that account goes delinquent for 45 days that the collection process comes in. Does that answer your question? Yes, sir.
I want to back up a little bit. So if a person comes out of prison, there's the expectation that they will begin to be able to pay those fees within 45 days, right after they come out of prison.
I would say it a little differently, and then we can do. The Board of Parole sets up a payment plan for those financial obligations. If they are current in that payment plan, then they are not delinquent. They become delinquent if they quit paying and 45 days runs, and then they become delinquent and we start our collections process.
Well, yes and no. I mean, what I'm getting at is this. You get out of prison, the parole board or whomever has an expectation that creates a payment plan. But the payment plan is based on the idea that they will be able to come out and get a job and be able to make those payments. And I mean, one of the things we're basically talking about here is the fact that in many cases you can't get a job when you get out of prison. So it seems like you're setting folks up for failure. If they come out of prison and you expect that they are going to have a job or be able to even begin a payment plan of some form, because in some cases, I mean, we are talking tens of thousands of dollars. And a payment plan of $50 a month is not going to make it if you want to be officially doing anything. What kind of payment plans are we talking about?
Well, those are established by the Board of Parole, so I'm really not the right person to be talking about that. And I don't know if the gentleman from Community Justice has any insider information on that would help. But I can give you a copy of the Board of Parole rules
I'll take a look
really
at those
about
at some point.
All I know about that process.
But you understand my point.
Absolutely.
That if you're setting it up so that someone's not, you know that they're going to have a great difficulty getting a job, getting any money in to pay for that, never mind housing or other things.
And the point I would make, Representative, is that on fines, judges have the ability to consider the future ability to pay of the offender. And so the legislature has said the minimum fine is $200, but the judge looks at that and says anything between that and the statutory maximum can come into play. So once that decision is made, I mean, again, restitution and compensatory fines is the single largest chunk that's out there for these felony offenders. And that is not ability to pay. That is a constitutional right of crime victims. And once that evidence is presented to the sentencing court, the court is required to impose that restitution obligation. And once that's done, they have a constitutional right for prompt payment.
I'm going to try to separate out a couple of things.
Sure.
The restitution, I understand, that's a different issue. The issue that I'm most concerned about, quite frankly, are the fines, the collection fees, the costs. Those are things that are imposed that are not, and I recognize, I mean, that as you said, the restitution and compensatory fines are a huge chunk of the amount that's owed. But for a number of people, those other three things that I mentioned also have a, and the last one, the supervision and jail fees, is a significant amount.
Yes.
But what I'm hearing is that the parole board can make some decisions. Where does the judge enter into those fines, not the restitution fines? Where does the judge enter into those fines after someone is released from prison?
Does not.
That's correct.
So there's no, so only the parole board has jurisdiction over what those, what, how those fines, those other fines are paid. Is that correct?
If I could jump in, kind of what happens, the simple answer is that when a person is placed on probation, they're under the jurisdiction or the authority of the court. When they go to prison, they now become the responsibility of the state. And once they release to post-prison supervision or parole, then they are still the responsibility of the state. That is divvied to each of the 36 counties for to enforce post-prison supervision conditions. I know, and I wasn't prepared to speak to this because I'm not with the parole board, but I do know from my experience that the parole board is very amenable to working with local parole and probation officers and probation departments in negotiating lengths of time to delay payment and also adjusting payments based on the ability to pay. Because I know Paul probably can speak to this as well, but we have people who come out and they're not, they come out of prison and they go into programs, and they may be in those programs for 9 months or longer, and are, and we don't want them to work. We want them to address their issues and problems that will help them be pro-social and be prepared to go to work. So,
and if I could chime in, you know, I think all of that is absolutely accurate. I think that Community Corrections, Parole and Probation does a pretty good job of managing and working with individuals to ensure, at least when they get out, that it isn't an undue burden initially. But I think the bigger issue is what you're touching on, Representative Frederick. It's these additional fines that add up. At some point, a person is going to have to pay. And most of these people, once they start working, are working minimum wage jobs, and their ability over time to make much of a dent can be, you know, pretty limited. And it just adds to the overall burden. So I think it's worth looking at.
Let me go back to something so that you understand where I'm coming from on this. I have people coming to me telling me that they have significant fines, that they do, there's no way for them to begin to pay them off. They lapse at some point. Collection agencies start to come after them. They get their wages garnished for those particular fines. So they're not even able, even if they're working, they're getting the money taken out. And they feel as though basically there's no way for them to get out of this situation. It is permanent servitude. As far as they're concerned. So, and then you add to it the supervision and jail fees especially the supervision fees. That's what I keep hearing about, that you end up with a number of every visit, every contact you have with your probation officer ends up costing you. And so they will say to me, I can't afford all these things, and they are at the lowest end of the economic spectrum in the first place. It's not as if they're coming out of prison and joining a hedge fund. They really have a very different situation to deal with. So I'm just curious about how we address those particular fees. Sure. And fines.
If I could speak to the parole and probation fees, they vary from county to county. In Multnomah County, they're about $40 a month. Those are waivable, and we do waive them on a case-by-case basis. We actually use them sometimes as a reward for folks making accomplishments in their supervision. We also will waive the supervision fees if they're making a concerted effort to pay their court fees and restitution. We prioritize restitution because we want the victims made whole. So we use that as a tool, but we don't hold it over folks quite the way you're describing it. I understand they may feel that way at times, but we do think that it's a tool, but also an obligation that each client has to make.
Well, there are two things that come to mind for that in responding to that. One is there are individual situations. Secondly, there are 36 counties.
Yeah, that's right.
That's correct.
That's right.
And
it's different in every county.
So it is. I'm not just hearing from folks in Multnomah County. I'm hearing from people who have friends who want to tell me about Umatilla County and want to talk as well about Jackson County. So these are the kinds of concerns that I have, and how we deal with that are the concerns that I
would add to that, and not to excuse any other county, but one of the benefits of Multnomah County is that over half of our budget for community corrections comes out of the county. In a lot of the counties, they are not funded to that realm, so I think it becomes more. I just understand their place is what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's the right way, but I understand where they're at.
And I understand as well that there's a national concern now because of the situations in Ferguson and other places where we saw a great deal of the budget based on the fees that they could get from different people. And there's a real concern and fear that in some other jurisdictions, not Multnomah County, that there's that this is a revenue source that is a required revenue source for other programs in the county.
Phil, why don't you carry on?
Sure. I just want to point out a couple of statutory provisions for you, Representative. And on the costs issue, so these would be primarily the costs of a court-appointed attorney and recovering those. The statute says the court may not sentence a defendant to pay costs under this section unless the defendant is or may be able to pay them. In determining the amount and method of the cost, the court shall take an account of the financial resources of the defendant and the nature of the burden that the payment of costs will impose. So there's at least some consideration at the time of sentencing about ability to pay there, and whether circumstances change that's certainly, I think, fair game for discussion. But the statute as written requires the court and prohibits the court from doing that unless they find that person has the ability to pay.
That's ability to pay as applied towards defense fees or any fines?
These are the court-appointed attorney costs.
It's 161. So that's limited, right. Okay.
Yes.
That's why I wanted
well,
to
and
clarify.
That, but the, I understand that. And, mm-hmm. and my point is that every statute has its own requirements, and some consider ability to pay, others do not, mm-hmm. and they do it in different ways. And so I understand that a dollar is a dollar eventually, but we have to be a little more precise and careful in how we look at this. So that the citation for that is 161.665 sub 4, if you want to look at that. The other thing I would just add is that the parole and the supervision fee is ORS 423.570, and the statute says that the fee shall be determined and fixed by the releasing authority, but shall be at least $25.
And there's no maximum?
I have a copy of this if you'd like to read it. It's not my not my thing, so I didn't spend a lot of time looking at it.
No, that's fine.
The let's talk about collection fees for a moment, if we can. The statute, again, directs the court to impose those fees. So one is when the person gets set up on a payment plan, there is a fee, and it's, I think it starts at $50, but that is a one-time fee. The other is if we refer it to a third-party collector, Department of Revenue or private collection firm, the legislature expects that to be a self-funding process. So the state does not pay the 18 or 22 or whatever percent of the collection entity to go out and do that. The offender is expected to pay that. That goes to the state, and the state provides the money to us to pay the collectors. But that's an example of an expectation by the legislator, or the budget at any rate, that that activity be self-funding and not a general funded activity. We do have some authority to move those and to waive those, depending on the circumstances, but you're absolutely right, that can get to be a significant amount of money. But that's, again, another example where I think at some point, if you really want to dig into this, we need to look at the individual statutes and see if you want to reconsider some of the decisions that previous legislatures have made. So the collections process, I think we've touched on briefly. Once the person is found guilty and sentenced, they are expected to pay in full or get set up on a payment plan. That typically is a probation case, and most felony offenders are put on probation. They may have jail as a condition of probation and a number of other things, but they are incarcerated for a brief, relatively brief period of time, and then they come back out and they're on community supervision. As long as that person is incarcerated, there is no collection activity by the court, and interest by statute does not accrue. The exception is if the court explicitly finds that person has the ability to pay while incarcerated. And so if there's some asset that's available to pay that, the court might make a different decision. If payments are current, the case stays at the court. Once they go delinquent, which is again is that 45 days, the court sends it to our central office, the Office of the State Court Administrator, which is OSCA there, for collections. We start with a demand letter, and then the statute authorizes a number of other things. In some cases, license, driver license suspensions. We refer them to third-party collectors. Department of Revenue can attach any tax refund that's owed to the offender, and then can also garnish wages in circumstances.
This is Rhett Parrish.
Yes. Go ahead, Julie.
A quick question, forgive me because I'm trying to find a good place to jump in. The TV on the computer screen does not match with the audio on my telephone. So going back to the collection, when people are, let's say they have a fine, they're in, that fine had gone into a collection agency, which I understand the collection agency charges the fees, et cetera. But if that person reoffends, did I understand that we suspend all collection agents' efforts that's not accruing interest, or just the ones that are active with the court are suspended, but our collection agency is still able to charge interest and things on those accounts if somebody's gone back into jail?
As long as that person is incarcerated, Rep. Parrish, then all collection activities end.
Hearing you. So they do get suspended, and there is no interest accruing on the part of the private collection agency.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So that's the overall court collections process. On reentry, it's a little bit different. The process begins with the release of the offender. The sentencing court will flag when that person is supposed to be released. It then checks with DOC and knows when that person comes out, and begin, that person is then subject to paying the court-imposed financial obligations. As we talked about briefly, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision is, by their rule, directed to send a schedule of payments to the court, and then basically that process remains the same. If they are current on their payment plan, they're fine. If they go delinquent after those 45 days, then our collection process begins. We refer to Department of Revenue for 1 year. If they can't collect, it comes back to us. We assign it to a private collections firm for 2 years. If they can't collect, it comes back to us, and we evaluate what to do with that, and we may just start the cycle again. But the case remains in collection status until it's paid in full or the judgment expires, which again can be between 20 and 50 years. The other thing I would point out is that when that person is being supervised in on post-prison supervision, that non-payment can be a violation that can result in a sanction. And so that's important in a couple ways. It's an enforcement tool to collect those things. But the other thing, if they are sanctioned in custody, in other words, they get 10 days in jail or whatever for non-payment, then that, again, suspends the collection activity. So it's a dynamic system. There's a lot of back and forth and a lot of different entities and competing interests involved.
I would add that for that violation to be upheld, you have to show that the person willfully did not pay. And that's a very difficult thing to do. Not that people don't do it, but you have to show that they have the money, they have the means, and they're choosing not to pay. So
now the part that you've all been waiting for. What can we do about this? I got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that generally the sentencing court loses jurisdiction over a case when the judgment is issued. And so when that person goes to prison, as we've discussed, it becomes a DOC issue and a Board of Parole issue and then community corrections. There is no specific statutory authority that allows a trial court to grab that judgment and amend it. It does happen on occasion. Some judges feel they do have the authority, either through the inherent authority of a court or some other mechanism, to do that. But in terms of a statute that says you may or you shall or under these conditions, that's not there.
Does that apply to municipal court cases as well? I thought muni courts held jurisdiction.
Rather than speculate, I'll just give you the honest answer, which is I don't know.
Because that's where a lot of the traffic, fines and fees.
It varies. Municipal courts, justice courts, and circuit courts all do a lot of it. I mean, in different counties, it's very different, but yes. The potential good news here is that in the 2015 session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 55. It tried to streamline and consolidate and make state agency collections more effective. But for purposes of this discussion, it also authorized a process for state agencies or the Department of Revenue or private collection firms on the agency's behalf to settle or compromise debts. So I think that is something that would be of great interest to you. On the judicial branch side, it authorizes the Chief Justice to develop those criteria to compromise those debts for all judicial branch agencies. So that would include the court-appointed attorney costs as well as the fines owed to the court. It does exclude judgments with restitution and compensatory fines for the reasons I think we already discussed. That process is just now starting. We're working with DAS and the executive branch agencies to see how they maneuver these things. And they've been looking more at centralizing collections, so not every board and licensing body is doing their own collections function. But we will be working with them. I think it's going to be a little challenging to establish classes of cases and circumstances where we can just turn it over to a collector and say, you have this kind of flexibility, go for it. But we certainly will be engaging that exercise and seeing where we come up. And then these are just kind of a summary of the things that I've tried to mention. The purpose of the state's criminal law, both in the Constitution and statutorily, includes holding offenders accountable. It also includes reformation and rehabilitation. So the legal structures to set up to recognize those competing interests and leave it to our policymakers to determine what the best course is. Compensating victims of crime, again, there's a constitutional right to prompt restitution. The legislature uses revenue to support public safety and a variety of other programs and services. As we look at systems and programs, there's always how those are structured and the cost to administer them. For example, if you're doing expanding community service, how do you set up a system where those people are certified and monitored and the reports are accurate and all that other fun stuff? And then, of course, ability to pay and impact on reentry. So that's my presentation. I'd be glad to answer other questions now or later.
Great. Thank you very much, Phil. Clearly, this is very complicated. And the you know, the purpose of this task force is to look for statutory fixes or perhaps allocations where appropriate to improve reentry. On this issue, I'm not sure where we would start. But if we're committed to doing this, I think we're looking at a serious effort, a long effort. But I would say potentially for me personally, it strikes me as a much needed effort to look at this as comprehensively as possible. But if we were to look at statutory barriers or statutory requirements, are there any in particular that kind of jump out at you as things that perhaps are fairly contained that the legislature could look at for improvements in the short run while we're working at a more comprehensive approach to this?
None that leap to mind right now. Frankly, what I can do is start talking to some of our presiding criminal judges in some of the larger courts, especially, see if they have particular ideas or things that they've flagged and have been looking for a forum to raise. But beyond that, we'd be more than happy to work with you as you continue this effort.
Yes.
I'm curious about, and maybe this is in here, but I don't see it. I haven't at least been able to put it together. Do we have, I realize that each case is different, but is there an average amount that comes out of each court case? Somebody who goes into prison, do they go into prison with a certain amount? And I'm not talking about restitution, outside of the restitution concerns, but the account maintenance fees and some of the other court fees that are in here, is there an average amount per person or per case?
I'm sure there is. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Or range would be fine, too.
Sure. And it, I think, would vary between the type of the offense, the person's criminal history, obviously the ability to pay. There's a lot of different factors that come in, but we can do some looking at that and kind of get you an idea of, and whether it's by person offenses, driving offenses, and we'll see what kind of makes sense and get you some information.
I would really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, Paul.
If I can make a comment, I think one of the challenges that I see is we work with people for them to be accountable, to be responsible for the debts that they have, but oftentimes it's not uncommon for a person to have all of the different types of fees and fines and restitution that you've mentioned, but also to have child support arrears, to have medical debt, to have private credit card debt, and people don't know where to begin. You know, it's not uncommon for people to think that they are in compliance and paying everything, and then all of a sudden they're being garnished. And there's, no real way that I figured out to streamline this process. And it's hard enough for my staff to figure out where these debts are and who to call, let alone some of the people who have them, who don't have the wherewithal to navigate these systems. And I think that's kind of the bigger challenge is, we want people to be accountable. We want them to make good on the debts that they have. But if they're being garnished at $6 of their $10 that they're earning an hour, how are they going to live? So being able to do it in a responsible manner, I think, is the real challenge.
To that end, we talk about, and we've talked about in this group, the ability to help folks before they come out of prison with understanding what their issues might be when they come out. It is financial management part of that presentation, part of that discussion?
because for a number of folks that I've run into, it's clear they didn't get that before they went in. And that may have been one of the things that got them into major problems, because they didn't know how to deal with credit card debt and medical debt and all these other things. I'm just curious whether we have that as a part of the. I mean, your group has a.
One of the more popular programs that we encourage in reentry is the Rentwell program, and part of that is clients accumulate their credit report, their civil record for evictions and any charges, as well as their. But looking at the credit report specifically, there is some credit counseling components to it that we're trying to enhance to help people understand how to contact them, look at which, if any, are dischargeable, what their legal alternatives are for some of the debt, and to structure it, and to let them know that if they become those, right now it's a few small percentage of people that actually contact initially the IRS or some of those people and make they're really amenable to making arrangements for them. That is just the one avenue that I know that most people in reentry can get some of that credit counseling service, and one of the things we're looking at adding to our Rentwell program to eventually help them not just get a Rentwell certificate, but maybe get some of those evictions or utility bills paid, get in compliance payment plans with other bills and outstanding debt. Maybe even have a microloan. Possibly we're looking into a little bit of a match savings program, structured like an IDA, but not an IDA, because those are statutorily restricted. So we could get them, we'll get the knowledge from Wentwell, work on their credit, maybe get to that 575, 625 range, which makes them a more attractive renter, as well as work towards a certificate of good standing we'll talk about later, and have that credit rating up there with some savings to help them overcome all the housing barriers. That would be the one area, unless people actually seek out individual credit counseling, which there is some agencies that provide it, but most often I see it paired and at a limited basis with Rentwell and any kind of rehabilitation to working towards certificates for people in housing.
So, Brian, the Rentwell program, is that something that happens post-release, or is there a pre-release component?
I would love to see it offered post-release. Right now, it's mostly pre-release. It's paired with other wraparound services. I would love to see credit counseling. There's some institutions that have volunteers and visitors and a couple of credit counseling programs you can participate in while inside, but it's really self-driven. But something that definitely would help people come out and be more prepared for their undertaking. The only other two things I made notes on.
But before you go on, actually a question for Truls. So, to what extent is that kind of counseling part of the probation requirement?
It isn't part of the probation requirement. I think it's much like Brian describing in the prisons. It's pretty much self-driven by the individual client. And we can refer folks to services that will provide that, but it really is somewhat driven by the individual client.
So you would have to, for some of the folks that I deal with, they don't know that they have a credit rating. Never mind the idea that they should go and learn how to deal with it. That's part of the concern that I have, that part of that education that might be necessary. What sort of numbers do you have of people who are taking advantage of it?
Numbers specifically?
What percentage of the folks, how many people are coming into classes, how many people are involved in the Rentwell or in the credit counseling?
And feel free to add.
Thanks. I'm at the same center he is, but mm-hmm. I've been there a little while longer. Rentwell classes are usually 6-week classes, and they have breaks in between them, and almost certain agencies offer them, and they only have placement for so many people. So it's a pretty small percentage. It's also kind of a delayed gratification idea, because you take the Rentwell in essence to get a rental unit, which most of them can't afford at that point in time anyway. So I don't think it's terribly attractive to people just for the financial piece. But we do send people over to places like Innovative Communities and Hacienda, other places that do have financial literacy courses
And I would add that one of the things we've done is we've partnered with local banks and had them come in and provide financial literacy classes, and I think some counties or other counties are doing that as well. The other thing that we've been able to do is start legal clinics. So we've got one through a partnership with the U of O Law School, where second and third year law students, supervised by pro bono attorneys, come and work with people once a month to look at things like child support arrears, financial obligations.
And that's post-release.
That's post-release in a reentry setting.
Thank you.
Yeah. You continue, Brian, please.
One of the thoughts that came to my mind is, depending on the disposition at judgment, a lot of the fines and the wide range that you'll see is, I think it's part because the judicial discretion, if someone has multiple felony counts, for example, and they take a plea bargain, they might have that one unitary assessment fee of $100 and have the rest of them waived. And I think some of the judges are looking at, if you take this to trial, you know, there's some costs associated with that. So there is some inherent parity for the amount of expense it costs for prosecution and defense. That some, I mean, I've seen the difference where some people come out with the same charges and it'll be the single $100 unitary assessment fee with the rest of the charges waived, and then maybe somebody they took it to trial that has $2,800 or a greater number because of the expense to the court. So I think there is some jurisprudence there at sentencing where it's a less expensive disposition, that there's some parity to the amount that's imposed. The only plan I've seen out there that addressed some of these fees and seemed really successful was Clackamas County has a annual amnesty period, if you would, and they have it set up where all the money that people put towards their fees during that period of time are matched so they can help bring them down quicker. And you know, when we look at the cost of collection, the cost of even mailing out the supervision letters and all the county staff at that level, the cost of attempting to collect it, that was really successful. I don't have the numbers on it, but that would be the place to look for an example of one way that they could get some revenue driven in, but also have some benefit to help erase some of the bigger debt when people are able to participate in a limited amnesty period annually or biannually.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think probably this is enough discussion of this topic for today, but, you know, I'd like at the next meeting, you know, first to think about what we want to do with this this issue. But, you know, it's one I think, I know people are paying attention to it nationally, and there are initiatives all around the country, and I think it's, you know, I think this is a conversation that needs to continue. Whether we're able to address it statutorily this session, you know, at least I think we need to authorize work around this issue. So I'd love people's thoughts about that. Good. Phil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very well. Yeah.
Thanks.
Good.
Okay.
Yes.
I have a question about House Bill 2986 that talks about the provisional driver's license. And there's some language in there that says that if they are reestablishing their driver's license privileges under this bill, they can establish a payment schedule with the court and begin making payments within 6 months after completing a pre-apprenticeship program and an apprenticeship program. So am I understanding that if they are enrolled in an apprenticeship program, they don't have to be making payments until 6 months after completing that program? It makes sense under a pre-apprenticeship program, but an apprenticeship program is a 4 to 5 year program, and I'm just trying to understand the language of the bill, because that would be 4.5 years before they had to actually start making payments on a debt.
Yeah, that really doesn't make sense, actually, because once they're in an apprenticeship program, they are earning
right.
a salary and would be in a position to begin to repay.
Right, right. It makes sense under the pre-apprenticeship program.
Right.
And wanting to make sure that we put some language in there that that not on completion of the pre-apprenticeship program, because usually it takes 3 to 6 months before they're even in an apprenticeship program and dispatched to their first job making a paycheck. So this, on a microscopic level in terms of fees and fines, might be something to do in terms of the language of this particular bill. So I've got a note.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, let's move to the subject of the certificates of good standing. And Chief Justice, please. It's a pleasure to have you. And on the phone, so who on the phone is addressing this? Is it
Mr. Chair, I believe Stephanie Sams is on the phone, and perhaps also Clark Holloway
okay.
from the Department of Licensing in Washington to contribute to this.
Okay, great. Well, let's start with the Chief Justice, and you know, I know that this whole topic is something of real interest to you, and in the last session you worked on legislation
successfully
that actually we never saw on our side, and so I would love to hear about what your intents were and you know, what you see as potential next steps.
Chair Dembro, members of the task force, my name is Paul DeMunis. I'm retired. I'm a constituent of Commissioner Carlson, and so it gives me the opportunity to thank her publicly for all of the work she's done in reentry, making things possible. Chair, my interest in this occurred in 2009. Although I was Chief Justice at the time, I was also a community member and had been working with different people in our community and had the privilege of meeting Paul at one time on reentry. And so I was privileged in 2009 working with Commissioner Carlson to found a resource center as part of the Marion County Reentry Initiative. It still operates today. It provides direct services to formerly incarcerated people, provides housing counseling, employment counseling. You had a discussion earlier about financial literacy. All of those things are embraced in that. And we founded at that time, I believe, if not the first, one of the first legal clinics in the country to address the legal issues of formerly incarcerated folks. Today, that legal clinic operates. It now operates both as part of the Resource Center, but also is now a nonprofit legal clinic that provides legal advice and services to formerly incarcerated individuals. And we also now represent those young people who have been incarcerated in OYA under Measure 11 sentences, who are aging out of OYA, who have been incarcerated for substantial periods of time, have turned their lives around, and if are not granted clemency by the governor, in other words, we file the petitions now. If not granted clemency, we'll have to go to DOC. So my involvement in this particular topic, and I'm by no means an expert, occurred a few years ago in a family dinner conversation. One of my sons is a criminal defense lawyer in Portland who works in expungements as part of his practice. One of my other sons owns a very successful investigation business, both civil, corporate, and criminal. And in this discussion, my son, who owns the investigation business, said to me, no employer who investigates the background of a potential employee goes to the courthouse to do that investigation. So there's no such thing as an expungement. That you can sign all the expungement orders in the world, sealing paper files, or thanks to e-court, sealing electronic court files now, and that has no effect on the internet. that there is a permanent record that is not, nothing happens when the judge enters an order. So that, and my view, I've been involved in the criminal justice system for 41 years. My view is that the criminal justice system should extend beyond putting someone in prison, that this, our society, our communities should have an obligation as part of the complete criminal justice system of assisting people who are reentering our communities and our society. It occurs to me that when I was chairing the governor's task force, or the governor's commission on public safety, one of the statistics, and this was raw data, was that if you took a snapshot of the 14,000 people currently incarcerated in DOC on any given day, you would find that 46% of them did not have to be there. That that almost half of them failed either on post-prison supervision or failed on probation. And since we know that reentry services are one of the major points in reducing recidivism, my view is we should be investing in reentry programs throughout this state. So I don't claim to be an expert, but I did draft the legislative concept that became House Bill 3437. And this is a very basic point I was making. A lot of very successful business people in the community had told me they would be much more interested in having a potential employee come with a certificate. Now, what we call it is another story, but to come with a certificate and actually present that certificate at the time of interview that honestly says, I was convicted of this crime, I did 7 years or whatever it was in prison, I've paid all my fees, fines, restitution, whatever it is, and I have a certificate signed by a circuit judge that says I'm in good standing. They would much prefer that than to have someone check the box that says they've never been convicted of a crime, or say in an interview they've never been convicted of a crime, and then when the background investigation occurs, of course, they find the mugshot, they find the, all of the things that indicate they were convicted of a crime, because there, in my opinion, there is no such thing modernly as expungement. So I think for this task force, figuring out a name for the kind of certificate is probably an important thing. I shied away from the, quote, certificates of rehabilitation because it was unclear to me whether judges would be comfortable in that, and I wanted a process that was, it seemed to me, as streamlined as possible. The goal here was not to create an adversarial process between the district attorneys and the people who were applying for a certificate of good standing, whatever it was, but to just say, here's the criteria. If you've done the criteria, then you are eligible for a certificate of good standing. I wanted to create a streamlined administrative process that a formerly incarcerated person could navigate without a lawyer. I also wanted to create a process that removed the adversarial process. In other words, the only objection that could be made by a district attorney was you don't comply. Not that you were a horrible person, you committed a horrible crime, blah, 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 but to say either you didn't pay your restitution or you didn't pay your fine or whatever it was. Now, I think it's open for debate how to do this. This was just my first attempt to do this, and I think there are two really main points here. One, I think that, as we said in our one-pager, a working Oregon is a safer Oregon, and I think this is just one tool in the toolbox of putting, helping people get a job. employment does not necessarily reduce recidivism, but it certainly is one major step toward reducing recidivism. The second aspect of this, and probably one of the most important, is the public relations campaign that has to be associated with this. You can have a certificate program, but if employers don't recognize it and don't see it as something that's valuable and important, it really is for naught. There's a lot of statistics out there. Anne O'Malley provided me with a great article the other day that just came that said forgiving versus forgetting. And I think that's a very helpful article for people to read about this. There are now 14 states that have certificates that differing, they call them different names. I liked when I heard somebody mention a certificate of restoration. This was a, House Bill 3437 was a very baby step toward this. It was not intended to remove disabilities that may exist by virtue of convictions where there, in other states, there are certificates that remove disabilities so that licensing, those sorts of things can occur. This was just a very basic step, and it included a provision to say that an employer who hired somebody and was aware of the certificate, were they to be a civil action brought against them for something that the employee had done, they would have a rebuttable presumption that they were not negligent in hiring that person. And so that's really the gist of this. I think that we, in the modern age that we live in, that we need to pursue this kind of transparency and honesty. And I thought there was another thing that could be done with this certificate, and that is when people are incarcerated, they earn certificates. Maybe they're a welder or a plumbing or whatever it might be. And those certificates are in their DOC file. But what if they could attach them to their certificate? That not only do I have a certificate of good standing, but I also am certified as a welder or whatever it might be. It seemed to me it created a much better package, if you will, for employment for people. And then I don't know how this language got in the bill. I did not. My concept was not a reentry court steering committee. I don't know how that got in there. I couldn't get it out once it was in there. What I wrote was, it would be a reentry council like we have in Marion County. That would be your first step to get, and they would just say you were eligible, and then you would take that letter of eligibility, and that would form the basis of your petition that you would file in the circuit court. I thought in doing this that we might be able to incentivize other counties to create reentry councils, because I said if you didn't have a reentry council, you had to take it to the Board of Commissioners. And I thought the board then, if it got passed, the Board of Commissioners in these other states would say, "Oh, we need a reentry council," because mm-hmm. we don't. But it never got. So I think this is this reentry court should probably not have. That was not my concept. And I'm glad the Chief Justice isn't sitting here saying I don't need another court, because that was never my intent. So thank you very much. That's my first time to wear long pants, a tie, and a suit this summer. So,
yeah. Apologize.
Well, thank you very much, Justice. Thank you for coming, and also for your interest in this and your work on this. I think. My sense is that there's a lot of interest in this among this task force, and the challenge before us is how to come up with a program that is workable, that's as simple as possible, but is workable, and that really does what we want it to. I think that with the passage of the Ban the Box legislation, a program like this is really essential, because, you know, the Ban the Box, gets rid of the box, and the notion is that the individual will be brought in for an interview and then will make his or her case of, you know, why they should be employed. What's missing, I think, is something that helps back up their claim that they're worthy of that kind of investment. And so something like this just makes a lot of sense. The question becomes, how do we do it in a way that is really easy for the individual, but also easy for the system, so that people will actually do it? And then, as you say, to get the word out that this really has meaning for employers. And I think, ultimately, just speaking for myself, I would be interested in seeing this extend into the housing world as well, you know, where somebody who's making a housing decision, can have some sort of assurance and maybe even, you know, as you say, immunity from or a presumption that they are making a, you know, that they're released from liability. I guess one question that I would ask you is, do you have a sense of why this did not go forward last time? Did anybody explain to you? I think it was a House bill, and it had a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee, I assume.
When I retired, I said it was probably good for me not to come over here, but just to stay teaching at the law school, and so I did not come to the hearing. There was a lobbyist retained for this by the business community. The bill passed out of the House Judiciary 8-1 with a due pass recommendation and never got a vote. And it's unclear to me why that was.
I did not know that.
Pardon?
I did not know that.
Presumably it went to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Your Honor, it was sent from Judiciary to Rules, and that's where it stayed.
Yeah, that's where
it... But it did have a public hearing in Judiciary.
Yeah. I mean, I can, Senator, I can analyze this. There are, when I look back on it, I can see ways to improve this draft. I can see there's more research that's been done about this in other states, and it can be improved. But it was never voiced to me what the concerns were at the time. I'm sure there were probably very legitimate ones, but I wasn't aware of them.
Does anybody have any questions of the Chief Justice? Let's take a couple of those, and then I want to go to Washington. And Justice, if you could stick around.
I'd like to. Yeah. I'd like to hear.
Great.
I just have a simple question. Did you say that they, in order to get the certificate, they had to have their fees and fines paid in full, not just being in good standing on a payment plan?
No, that was that they had to be paid.
Completely paid in
full?
Yeah. Okay.
And now, that's certainly subject to negotiating, trying to figure out. You know, as Mr. Lemon said, for example, restitution can be a long-going thing. And so I could see you could amend this to include those kinds of things. But I'm just such a basic person. This was what I started with, thinking that it would probably... people would bring up questions like that along the way and we could move to something, but it never got that far. But I think that's a very legitimate the language of this bill actually excludes some people from ever getting a certificate because they will never be off post-prison supervision. So that, and it was written that way. It was written not to say, well, this category of crime can't do it. It was written to say the way it was, and that just naturally will exclude some people.
Yes, please.
Work on this. So something, and it may have come up before it became good standing when it was in the early stages, but I think a question that our parole and probation folks have in terms of, so say somebody is doing well and then they relapse into a prior lifestyle while they have their certificate. Who's liable if PNP says, well, they put their stamp behind this person, then all of a sudden the person isn't doing as well.
They can go to court and revoke them.
Right. So who's responsible for doing that?
The
PNP can revoke it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And I, Commissioner, I may be wrong about this, but it seemed to me that the bill said it was.
I was trying to read it on my phone.
I think, and I just picked this up a couple of days ago, but I started looking at it. The bill. My recollection was it was a year after you had completed all of this that you were eligible to apply.
Okay.
To eliminate the ongoing problem, but then if you let's say you were convicted again, then there could be a revocation of that, and then it was a criminal violation if you had your certificate revoked and you misrepresented that you.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we move to hearing from our friends from Washington. So, Stephanie, are you on and available?
I am.
Okay, great. So if you could tell us about the program up there that is just getting underway, as I understand it.
Yes, it just went into effect June 1st. Just to give some perspective, my name is Stephanie Sams. I'm a policy and legislative analyst with the Washington State Department of Licensing. DOL is responsible for licensing and regulating drivers. We also register vehicles and vessels. And then the applicable piece here is that we manage over 44 professional and business licensing programs in the state. That division that does that is the Business and Professions Division. They are the division that I work with. And they, like I said, license and regulate over 44 professional and business licensing programs. That includes, for example, cosmetology, architects, geologists, tattooing and body piercing and body art. And then, it's a big mixed bag, and then we have vehicle dealers and manufacturers, just for a couple of examples. This year, we had a bill that passed. It was second in gross substitute House Bill 1553, and it created the certification of restoration of opportunity. So DOL's part in that is more or less a middleman. Individuals who qualify for a CROP, as we call it, Certification of Restoration of Opportunity, they apply for it through the Superior Court. They apply in the county in which they live and the county in which they were convicted. So, for example, if they live in King County but they were convicted in Yakima County, they would apply in both counties. So the Superior Court is responsible for determining whether the individual qualifies for the certification of restoration of opportunity. And once they qualify, they are then able to come to the Department of Licensing, for example, and say, I meet all the other requirements to get a license in cosmetology. Here's my CROP, as well as the proof that I meet the requirements to get my cosmetology license, and the department cannot use their previous conviction as a reason for denial. There are other agencies in Washington that are mentioned in the legislation. For example, the Department of Health, they have all of the healthcare related licenses, and then the Department of Social and Health Services. So I can give you an overview of the CROP legislation and then kind of go into like a slight more detail about how it has impacted the programs at the Department of Licensing. But I am no expert on the crop legislation that beyond how it has impacted our agency. But I do have some information that might be useful given the previous conversation.
Okay. Yes.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify, because Washington Department of Licensing was going to be on the phone already for the driver's license suspension information, she kindly agreed to chime in on their experience with the certificate of restoration that it just passed. So
right.
That's what she was referring to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Yes, thank you, Sam. Stephanie.
Sure, not a problem. So there are folks who do not automatically or who are automatically disqualified from getting a crop. For example, there can be no Class A felonies, no sex offenses, and it's the crime included sexual motivation or extortion in the first degree, they cannot qualify for a crop. They also have to meet certain time periods. For example, it has to be 1 year for a misdemeanor, a gross misdemeanor has had to have passed, or 2 years for a Class B or C felony. So when an individual is applying for this crop to the Superior Court would look at all of this information and determine if they meet these requirements. And to get to the fees, you either have to have paid all of your fees or be on a plan to pay them off and be in good standing on that plan. So while you're on a crop, you cannot have any further arrests or convictions or pending charges, or you lose the crop. And depending on the license, you could also lose your license. So a crop, in order to apply for a crop, it is considered a new civil action in a qualified court. They fill out the forms and then they have to provide the information that would support their application for the crop. And then they, like I said, they will bring that crop to the licensing agency, whether it's DOL or Department of Health. And then they would show that they meet the qualifications for the license. So how it's kind of impacted us since it's been implemented, I will say, since it is so new, we actually haven't seen any of these crops come through. The reason for that could be that they're still going through the court process to get this certificate. Also, Department of Licensing rarely denied applications for licenses for criminal convictions unless it had a direct nexus to the program. So more specifically, there are some of our licenses that were exempt from acknowledging these crops. So those are our security guard, bail bond, private investigators, real estate brokers, and our notary publics. They were exempt from the crop legislation. However, even then, if denial would happen, it's most likely due to the profession. So for example, someone who is convicted of negligent homicide would not necessarily be prohibited to receive a real estate license. Some of our license programs before crop also and moving forward with crop, if they deny a full license due to the criminal background related to the profession, they could also offer a probationary license where applicants can get a probationary license for a certain period of time, and then once that time passes, they're eligible for a full license. And then the other component of that is if they are denied a license regardless of whether it's for background or a criminal background, they can appeal to the appeal board and have that reviewed. And then the crop would again come into play and be considered.
Stephanie, do you know if, I mean, you mentioned that none has come forward to the licensing board, but do you know if any crops have been issued?
I don't know. I was trying to look around to see if I could find that information for you all. I might still poke around and see what I can find and pass that on to Cheyenne if I find any, mm-hmm. if that would be useful.
It would be. I mean, you know, what we're hoping to do is come up with something that, you know, just the right way of pursuing and issuing these certificates. And so something where, you know, the process, you know, we want to see that people are being encouraged to use the process and are actually using it because it's, you know, it's easy and it gets them somewhere.
Right. Absolutely. Also, there is a component to the legislation that speaks to employers and housing providers, where they ask employers and housing providers to consider the crop when considering the ex-offenders. But they are not legally required to consider
it, but they're just encouraged to. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, does anybody have any questions? One of the things I noticed in the legislative history was that this bill passed unanimously in both chambers.
Yes, it did.
Which is impressive. Paul.
I've got a couple questions.
A lot of momentum, and hopefully we see a lot of good things come from it.
Right. Paul.
Stephanie, do you know, has there been like a public education component that's gone along with this process? And do you know how long the application review process is?
Sorry, I can't. It's kind of hard to hear some of the folks on the phone.
Yeah.
Do you want me to come around?
Yeah, whatever.
Has there been a public education process that's gone along with this legislation? And do you know how long the application review process is? Can you speak to either one of those things?
I can speak to the first part. I'm not really sure about the second. But to the first, there is a organization in Seattle and King County called Columbia Legal Services. They were instrumental in writing the legislation with some of the representatives, and they are doing a multitude of workshops. And last I heard, they were going to be working with the courts to try to train them on what they should be doing and or how they can help ex-offenders through this process.
Great.
So they, like I said, they're Columbia Legal Services, and they have a web page on crops. They've been pretty active in this.
One further question. Is there any mechanism in place once a certificate has been awarded to ensure ongoing compliance? Or any recognition method for anybody that runs afoul after being awarded?
So as far as we're concerned with licensing, if we give them if they get a crop and then they're eligible for a license and we give them a license to practice, we would hold them to the same standards that we would hold all other people with that license. So if they violate something within the code of conduct for that license, their license will then be revoked. Now, there isn't anything in the legislation that states that that has to be reported back to the court or anything, so I don't know how that will play out.
Okay.
Thank you.
I do know that if someone has a crop and they commit another crime and they are arrested, they lose their crop, but then they can re-qualify for a crop in the future once they meet those requirements again, the time requirements.
And Stephanie, do you know if there's any relationship between parole and probation and this process?
Unfortunately, I do not know.
Okay. Anyone have any other questions of her on this subject? Okay. Well, thank you, Stephanie. All right. Shall we move over?
You're welcome.
Shall we move over to the driver's license suspension issue?
Absolutely. And Clark Holloway is here, and he'll walk you through that.
Great, thanks. Thank you. Good to see you.
Hi, this is Clark Holloway. What I understand is what you're interested in is the suspensions for fail to appear or pay on traffic tickets. Is that correct?
Mr. Holloway, this is Cheyenne Ross. I'm staff. That's correct. It's our understanding that Washington law permits the Department of Licensing, in effect, to ignore the requirement to spend for a failure to pay, which is court costs typically. Is that accurate, and that's what the task force is interested in hearing about?
Okay, it's in effect it's accurate. It's not exactly how it works, but what originally happened back in 2012 area was legislature was concerned about the number of people suspended for failure to appear or standard pay, and then the effect it had, especially on the disadvantaged and people that don't have the abilities to make those payments. So the original bill would have just had the department not suspend for any failure to appear that somebody might get for a traffic offense. But the state patrol was concerned on that about the traffic safety or moving violations that they thought, and our data backed up, there is a tie between fail to pay tickets for such things as speeding or driving while suspended that are moving violations. So they put an exemption in this bill that just said that the department would not suspend for non-moving violations. Then they gave the department the authority to adopt a rule as to define what was moving and non-moving. Prior to the bill going into effect, the department averaged about 25,000, give or take, notices of failure to appear a month. When the bill went into effect and we started taking action only on moving violations, it dropped to around 12 or 13,000 a month. And we didn't retroactively take people off suspensions if we had suspended earlier for a non-moving. But since that time, we have seen the total number of suspensions drop as people take care of the problem or take care of the payments or enter into a payment agreement. Or sometimes just the length of the citation that has been on the record so long that it drops off the drive record after 15 years. Mm-hmm. The other issue we had was the department, Washington State, does belong to the Non-Resident Violator Compact, which requires that the department suspend the Washington driver's license for a person who is licensed in Washington who gets a failure to appear in another state that belongs to the compact or a similar agreement, and we do have a similar agreement with Oregon. So there was an exception put into the statute that we would go ahead and suspend for any moving or non-moving traffic violation if it was related to the compact. but there's not, we don't get as very many of those.
Mr. Holloway, did the Department of Licensing sponsor the measure? Because I know that the national organization supports the idea of only suspending from moving violations. Were you guys involved?
Right. We didn't support it. We it was, or we, excuse me, we did support it. We didn't propose it. It came originally from legislator in Seattle, I think, that this has been a concern of his for several years. What we did was work with him to help define what the moving and non-moving were. There was a lot of debate as to whether a drivable suspended ticket should be moving or non-moving. And so we assisted on that and gave some information on, the, like I said, the data from our, as to whether there was a tie between tickets and accident involvement. And then we, you know, we worked out the issue with the non-resident violator compact, but and we didn't, we did not oppose the legislation in any part, of course, but we are sympathetic to the only wanting to take action on moving violations.
Right. And Clark, where did you come down on the driving while suspended? Was that considered a non-moving offense?
No, that one, like I say, was controversial, and that one of the reasons we ended up with the definition requirement that the DOL do the definition of moving and non-moving was because during the session that nobody could agree on it, so they left it up to us, which we greatly appreciated. But our data does show a definite tie between driving while suspended tickets and accident involvement, so we did came down as defining it as a moving violation.
But did you look at what the reason for the suspension was? I mean, I've seen research that shows that people whose license has been suspended for moving violations, if they then drive, even though their license is suspended, they have a higher rate of accidents than those who were, you know, who are driving, but their license was suspended for a non-move-in.
Right.
Which, and in the latter, it seems like it's pretty close to the general population.
Right. But, yeah, and we did discuss that issue. The only thing, like I said before, we didn't go retroactively on this, so some of the driving while suspends that we might get historically would be for some non-moving offenses, but all the ones we've got going into the future, the only way you'd be suspended would be for a moving offense. So the legislature felt that it would work itself out at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's a good point. It was moving violations when you include driving while suspended that were tied to the re-offense. For the accident
ball. Right. Okay, group it. Questions? Clark, we're I think we, you know, we're seriously considering legislation like this. Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions to us, any recommendations for us to think about up front?
One of the issues, like I said, it's hard to get people to disagree what a moving and non-moving violation is. By giving us the authority to adopt the rules on it, we had a lot of pressure from the interest groups from during the legislative process after the session was over. But we, you know, we did. We're able to show through the data analysis what the impacts were, and eventually everybody came on board with it. But that's probably where you're going to have to spend your time most on it is trying to decide what should be included and what shouldn't, because there's some strong feelings on that.
Mm-hmm. And have there been any problems with it since You know, since it's been in effect, have there been any calls for changes to be made in the program?
Not at this point. One of the things that we've heard is that the number of total citations being issued is actually going down a little bit. And some people think that might be tied to concerns that law enforcement is reluctant to issue a citation if they know that there's no penalty, no driver's license penalty for fail to pay. So a lot of the non-moving tickets, we're starting to see a hint there that there might be a drop in receiving those. I don't know how that would, you know, we don't get our funding from ticket revenue, but for courts that do, that might be a concern.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that answers my question. Cheyenne, is there anything about that we haven't thought of? Okay, Clark, Stephanie, thank you very much for giving us your time.
Not a problem. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Okay.
Interesting discussion.
Thank you. Okay, take care.
You too.
Yep. Okay. Actually, let me.
I didn't want you to forget the child support piece of the debt discussion.
Right.
Sort of bounced around.
Yeah, and I thought we'd move next to the issue that Commissioner Carlson raised, and that involves the child support issue. Yeah. Just, you know, for those of you who are here or on the phone, do I get a sense that this is something we should be moving forward on, trying to come up with something
absolutely
like this?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, then. We'll talk about some drafting. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Hearing no objections. All right. Let's move to under discussion of next steps. Actually, this was our sort of catch-all category, and I think Mike Schmidt has something to talk to us about with short-term temporary leave. But before we get to that, Commissioner Carlson raised an issue about some problems that have surfaced that she's become aware of with respect to requirements around child support and the fees that are attached to that, I think. Anyway, rather than give an introduction, let me just turn it over.
So, well, are you both going to come up? You can do it. So this is Conchetta. Is that it?
Conchetta Swessinger.
Right. And
Janine Wiesner.
Yeah.
And
Mara.
Great. Okay, so three of you.
Should we have them?
So we invited these three ladies to come to our local Marion County Reentry Design Team to talk with us about what was going on with child support. And we had a discussion here about... particularly with regard to driver's license suspensions and child support that had come up. And I was just interested to know exactly how it fit with the reentry client population. And they're doing some really great work around working with people. But and I'll just throw out what I learned, and then I'm going to let them just talk the same way they talked to the group, because they're the experts and I'm not. But one of the things that they talked about is this modifications of child support orders, right? And the concept that when you go into prison, if you don't get that child support order modified, then your child support requirement just keeps accruing while you're in prison. You have to proactively fill out an application form. And then once you get out of prison, after 60 days, right, then it picks back up again at the very same level, again, unless you've had a modification downward. So that led to all kinds of questions about, so How do people that go to prison know about this? Evidently, there's a packet of information that they get at Coffee Creek when they check in, but we don't know for sure, and this is where I've been in touch with Department of Corrections and haven't had a chance to close the loop, whether they actually sit down with them and fill out the forms with them, or if it's just like, here's a packet of 50 pages of paper, and hopefully you'll find that one and fill it out. They have said that you get emails from folks, right, saying we're in prison, but that's not enough. And then the other part that we talked about was that if you find, it was a question from one of our providers. So what if someone's out of prison a year or 2 years, and then they find out that they've been out of prison that long? Well, it goes all the way back to the 60th day. It's retroactive. Yet if you're in prison, say 5 years, and you submit this paperwork in the fourth year, it's not retroactive. I mean, and so maybe we don't agree that policy is necessary or whatever, but it just seemed like it was really heavily weighted on the one end and not on the other end. So then what we found out was that none of this is in statute. It's all an administrative rule from the Oregon Department of Justice. And in fact, up until recently, when they, sounds like they changed the administrative rules, you couldn't actually initiate for someone, which you can now, right? The rules kind of changed.
Right.
So that's my introduction, Gospel According to Janet, how I understand it, and so fill in the gaps so that they kind of understand what you do and how child support works with this population.
Certainly. Chair Dembrow, Commissioner Carlson, and committee members, thank you very much for having us talk briefly today. Commissioner Carlson's absolutely right. One of the populations that we work with, and here in Marion County, in my office, we have quite a few customers who are incarcerated obligors. We work with them because the truth is, when someone goes into custody, and most people that have families, if you're divorced or you have a paternity case with someone, one party is ordered to pay child support. And the minimum order that we normally see, there's some exceptions, but the normal minimum order is about, you know, and it's all based on income. It's all based on calculations that are income on the both parents. But the normal minimum order is $100 a month. So if someone becomes incarcerated and is going to be away for a long period of time, often, as everyone here probably knows, they don't necessarily, a lot of times, have an ability to earn income or to pay that support order. So that while the child support program, if we find out that someone's in custody, we don't necessarily take, you know, a lot of strenuous enforcement action against that person. Chair or Commissioner Carlson, you're absolutely right. The person's judgment, unless they ask to modify it downward, continues to accrue. So essentially, the minimum amount of child support that's going to accrue on an annual basis for anybody, unless there's some exception, is about $1,200 a year. And so if that goes on for several years, it can create long-term a barrier to that person when they get out, and it's just another debt, and it's a debt that there are a lot of significant measures that are taken, and it's a debt that is significant and provides some barriers for that person. So our program does have a way, when we find out and have a reasonable belief that the person will be incarcerated for over 60 days, to look at it, and if by rule, if the person is going to earn less than $200 a month, the presumption is that person has no ability to pay, so that's what we call our modification to zero. So we would proceed that as part of the program. We would take that and then move to modify that support order. And until recently, that person, or if the other party wants to request it, one of the parties would have to request that we do that. So we couldn't just do that on our own. That has recently changed, so that if the program itself it becomes aware and has proof that the person will be incarcerated for 60 days or more, we can proceed on our own motion to modify support. So, I mean, that's, and I think the program feels very strongly that that's an important measure, because on the one hand you have families, but on the other hand you also have barriers. And I know at the federal level that statistics have shown, or studies have shown, that if you have unrealistically high support orders that accrue over time, there's less and less of a real reality that the person's ever going to be able to pay or will pay that support order. And it, you know, becomes a barrier to that person. A lot of times people unfortunately give up and then just don't, you know, pay their obligation. So we do have that. I briefly spoke with Kate Richardson, who is our statewide director in the child support program. I am aware from her that Commissioner Carlson, she also is, you know, she's very active at the federal level, and that the feds are looking at more and more at, you know, other opportunities to look at this issue again, and that the program as a whole is planning at some point in the future to be looking at other types of abilities to modify. I mean, one of the questions I think that has come up is, okay, so then someone gets out of custody, you know, and it's 61 days, so by operation of law, maybe they were an accountant, I think is the example we gave at your meeting before, and they got convicted of fraud, and they go to prison for 5 or 6 years, and they get out, and because they were an accountant and they had a good job at the time, they might have a judgment of $500, $600 a month. But when they get out, the likelihood they're ever going to be an accountant or operate at that level again is pretty low. And so the reality is they have this judgment that's accruing when they get out 61 days afterward that's going to, you know, a very high level and going to accrue arrears pretty quickly. So I think the program is looking at that issue and whether or not there's more we can do at the program level in the future on that. And can we, you know, is there something we need to do with the modifications and being a little more nimble on the modifications at that? So that's at the baby stages at the program-wide, statewide level. But so we're very proud of the work that we do and we've done, but there's obviously more work that can be done as well.
I just wanted to emphasize that they have to be incarcerated for 6 months. I think you said 60 days, a time or two, just misspoke. But and when we get the modification request, it has to be 6 months at least from the point we get the request. Like, they couldn't have been in there for 5 years and now they're going to get out in 2 months. We couldn't help them then. It has to be 6 months from that time we get the modification. And it's not retroactive to the time they go in.
And is that a federal rule, or is that a state? Is that just part of state law being implemented through state administrative rule?
I don't know, because there's a federal layer. You know, we're a federally mandated program, so there are a lot of federal rules that we have to follow in terms of how we do modifications. So I don't honestly know off the top of my head on that.
But one of the things that I approached Cindy, well, I ran into Colette Peters. At Bentley. So, and then I said, hey, we've been talking about these things, and maybe this is a topic for the Governor's Reentry Council also to look at, because it's more administrative perhaps than legislative, unless we want to put some of these things into state law if we could, and we don't even know if we could. And so she's connected me with some folks inside, and again, we haven't had a chance to talk yet. But so part of the question is whether or not we could actually amend those administrative rules to be able to have more flexibility on these types of things. So that's really what
I was trying to get. Right. And I know that Kate Richardson, our director, statewide director, wanted to be here today. And this is something that she's been looking at, you know, pretty carefully herself. But she's got was delayed with some other meetings, so wasn't able to.
It's the annual DA's conference that's going on. She was apologetic and really appreciated the invitation. And she did emphasize there are 24 other counties that have equivalents that are all trying to administer them.
There's a statewide component to the program, and there's our 25 counties total that have an active part of that program.
But we can certainly follow up with questions and extend invitation at a later date or the chair's direction.
Mm-hmm. So, but just to clarify, the kinds of administrative rules and processes that you're talking about are just limited to Marion County, and it varies.
Statewide.
No, this is statewide.
This is statewide.
And the ones I sent you are the state administrative rules from DOJ.
And so is it your sense that this is something that can be handled just administratively? Improvements made administratively?
I think there is a good likelihood we could do that. Certainly do. We've done a lot of that in the past. Again, normally the program is very careful to vet everything, because they also have to be vetting what's the federal requirements are as well. But yes, a lot of what we do with guidelines and calculations with child support is done in rule.
It seems to me if it could be done administratively, the best possible thing would be to stop everybody who goes into custody that's been in custody for more than 6 months or whatever the requirement is. And what I would like to know is what the effectiveness of DOC's policy change to start issuing the forms, because I know they did that a while ago, and I know it's made a big difference for a lot of people. But as you pointed out, Commissioner Carlson, I'm not quite sure how that is actually done and whether every single person who goes through Coffee Creek intake, the intake process, actually understands what's in front of them and what the percentage of people who have child support obligations are actually filing the paperwork. That
well, exactly.
Would be really...
So do they just see the form and then they send an email and say, I'm in prison, and they think they've taken care of it. Mm-hmm. And then it just ka-ching, ka-ching, and all of a sudden they have this big debt. So.
Yeah.
I know historically that the statewide program has had someone that has gone over to Coffee Creek and provided forms. I'm not totally certain as to the extent of the work that they did. And we are, you know, that's a question that's come up for us as to whether or not that continues. And so I know that Maury, I think, was going to do some follow-up work a little bit on that, too. Because, Commissioner, you had had a question about could, you know, our county staff maybe do a little bit of outreach. And certainly we would be willing, but we need to coordinate with the state program as well.
Right. Well, we were trying to figure out locally how we might solve this, although, I mean, certainly every other county in the Oregon is dealing with the same thing. But the idea that if we become aware that someone is going into prison because it actually happens in our courts and our district attorney is generally involved in that, could there be some sort of a notice that goes over on the other side so that we're paying attention to who's not filling out the forms and putting them in? But if there were revisions possible to the administrative rules to allow it to be retroactive, for example, then that would become less important. Do you see what I'm saying? As long as you were picking people up, because right now we want to pick them up as soon as possible so that the clock stops when the paperwork is filed.
Well, and I think we spoke about one of the barriers that is there now is that we don't always know when someone's in custody for 6 months or more. I mean, there's no automated, easy way to learn that, so you do end up relying on people letting you know.
Is this 6 months or more a state rule, or is that a federal rule? Do you
That's
know that?
By OAR, Oregon Administrative
Rule. Right, because I wonder, the other part that we talked about was jail and the difference between jail and prison. Mm-hmm. And so someone goes into jail, and they might be held for a year or less under community corrections, but then you don't know if they're going to get time, you know, when they're in pretrial, you don't know how long they're going to be there, and then they get credit for time served, so would that drop them less? And I mean, these were the conversations we were having in this meeting. So there might be something that we also want to address in terms of jail, particularly under the Justice Reinvestment Act, where we're trying to do probation and those types of things and shorter jail sentences more and more. That 6 months thing kind of seems at odds mm-hmm. with that a little bit to me. So just throw that out as a concept as well.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Yeah, I was going to say this seems to fall in the category of some things that we could do at pre-entry that would help re-entry, you know, having the awareness and other items being like having some mechanisms in place to get assistance with the power of attorney to close bank accounts before people go in, to arrange for a voluntary repossession of a vehicle rather than a full repossession. There's just a lot of things that could come, you know, and unfortunately Coffee Creek intake would be where you'd catch most of them that are meeting the amount of time that these things are going to be an issue, because it is quite a technical process to fill out the actual, get the paperwork, and with all the different level of services and legal assistance available at different institutions, it varies widely. You know, having that at the pre-entry of, you know, Coffee Creek or intake would be a, you know, a good way to alleviate some of the problems that we face at re-entry.
No, I'm glad you mentioned that, Brian. I had a conversation last week with Alex Bassos from the Multnomah County Defenders. That's the guy who did the cheat sheet here. They're looking at trying to create some sort of statewide program for pre-entry where they could be a resource to the state. And I'm thinking of inviting him to our next meeting to talk to us about what it is that he's proposing. That could certainly help with this. But I do like the idea of retroactivity, because that way, you know, the issue of whether you know that someone has been, you know, is headed for jail is or prison becomes not so acute. I mean, you'll know, and then retroactively an adjustment will be able to be made. So, you know, if that's something that could be handled through administrative rules, that would be great, I think. But, you know, what would be useful for us would be to get a sense of, you know, what you can do or what can be done through administrative rule where, you know, federal law is a problem, but where it would be useful for us to look at a state statutory change to make this happen.
Right, because from what we could see or what you said, the state statute is really silent around someone going into prison. All the rules have been created underneath that administratively. And so then it's always a question about, is it better off being silent? And then mm-hmm. we have the flexibility of administrative rule. But silence is not always the best way to go, because then you're at the mercy of whatever the administrators are saying works best. So I don't even know if a policy statement in legislation, you know, might be worthwhile to have some sort of overarching that we acknowledge that people that are in prison have a different set of circumstances than what you would have outside. But anyway, just throwing out ideas.
Well, it may be that we may want to craft some policy around pre-release at some point, and then this could be part of that. I mean, I think we would want to give broad directives in any case, not too specific, but yeah.
Well, one of the things that have helped just being involved with reentry, and Janine had mentioned this today, was the beauty of education, just having sitting in a room with parole and probation and telling them the importance of their clients. If they reoffend and they go to prison, they really need to have a request for modification. So just this having the resources and networking will make a big difference. And the same with the SOAR program and people at Bridgeway. Just this amount of education alone will, you know, help change things with everybody involved.
Chief Justice's comment about the value of a council, it's going to be reinforced.
Oh, it just seems to me that there's a maybe not so simple, but it seems like there should be an easy technological way.
Kind of checklist.
Just either a checklist or an acknowledgement. If you have your name listed as someone who is supposed to be paying a certain amount, that any time that name comes up, somehow that should be in a court case, that should be, or in a ruling, that should be easily part of the and maybe it's not e-court, but it should be part of some system that would easily come up there.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the way that cases are flagged for SSI. I think on a monthly basis in the jails and in DOC, those cases are flagged, and if a person's in custody for more than certain number of days, then they stop payment.
Right.
You know?
App benefits or
right.
similar
programs. It's, yeah. We're not talking about
it
rocket science
here. Seems like this
here.
Should be an easy system to a little bug to put in the system that would work, but I think I'm thinking too easily on it, but we should be able to do something with that.
I think this was a number of years ago when we first tried to do outcomes around this with the reentry initiative, and the feds wanted to know how many people were paying their child support. And we ran these things back and forth because of the privacy laws, right, and your ability to release information. So I think it's a one-way communication piece where we could provide them lists of lots of people, and then they could go back and figure out if they were paying child support. But they can't provide lists of people paying child support to PNP or the criminal justice side to find out whether or not they're incarcerated, right? Am I getting that right? Yeah.
Still, I mean, the SSI situation seems equivalent.
Yeah, I don't know how they do that. So.
Well, and I think there's a reality right now. I mean, the program is undergoing a fairly massive, significant computer system reboot and, you know, new system. And I know there is a hope over time when the new system is implemented, there may be more ability on automated discussions back and forth that would be helpful. And I don't know if this could be a part of that or not, but I can certainly talk to Director Richardson and make sure it's sort of on the top of her mind to be thinking about as well.
I'm always concerned about privacy issues in terms of technology and in terms of data. But there's an expectation, I think, in the general public that government agencies are talking with one another. And this, I mean, they may not be, but I mean, this seems to be one a good example of where they should be if they're not. So I just keep that in mind.
The flagging something Multnomah County does everybody do that? Flagging
no,
SSI? I don't know if you
know. No, yeah, that's, I think that's statewide or national when the Social Security, right. Once someone's incarcerated for some yeah. Mm-hmm. So much time there. Those benefits are cut off. I mean,
that
obviously
program works.
They do that because there's a motivation there for
exactly.
It.
So but who flags what?
Right. I don't know how the process
That's
works.
The question I have.
But it, as
and it's through the court system or through
some sort
but
of.
But they have some kind of way of knowing as Representative Fredrickson said, yeah. There must be a way to tap into how they do it.
Exactly. That's why I say, you know, let's
try to find out yeah. The answer to that. That's a good question. Just, you know, while you're here and while we're talking about child support, you know, earlier we were talking about the driver's license suspension, and failure to pay child support is one of the triggers for that, right? One of the non-moving triggers for that.
It can be, yes.
And do you know much about this? And
yes.
You know, if we were to, you know, to craft legislation that would remove non-moving offenses from, you know, triggering suspensions, how would child support play into that?
Chair, I can't speak completely for the entire program. I can tell you that license suspension is one of the what we consider last resort sorts of consequences that we use. So not everybody, you don't just like I owe $50 and wham, your license is suspended. There's a criteria, there's a threshold of you have to owe $2,500 or more in support, and there has to be some significant outreach done to try to get what's called a compliance agreement worked out with the obligor before we can do anything. And it is a very successful consequence, but it's a last resort consequence. And the program does look at it as very much a last resort and don't use it except when there's just very, you know, you've tried almost everything else and it doesn't work. So I think there is, I think, at the federal level some requirement that you have license suspension in some sort of form. I don't know totally what the requirement is, but there is some federal requirement on that. But it's one that I think from my perspective as the head of the child support unit in Marion County, that I would be very concerned if it was something that was taken away from us in terms of, you know, completely without further, you know, discussion.
So is that applied the way you described it in every county, or does each county have discretion in how they use that tool?
No, by statute there are rules as to what you can do, and then there are administrative rules that the whole program has to follow. So it is a program-wide mm-hmm. Requirement. There mm-hmm. there is some flexibility in terms of compliance agreements and stuff, mm-hmm. but there's not flexibility in terms of thresholds and stuff.
And one of the programs that we use lists all the licenses that they have, so professional license and driver's license, or if they're set up correctly or if we know about them. So when we go to suspend, it can suspend all of their licenses.
Fishing licenses.
Fishing, yeah. Fishing license, driver's license, barber's license.
But
State
it's
bar license.
Yeah, again, State the goal bar. Is never to, oh, I got to suspend a license. The goal is to, you know, work with people in terms of compliance and working out. And, you know, we have tools in the tool chest, and the bottom line is our goal is always to work with parties to make sure orders are reasonable, to make sure that we have an understanding of where people are at and what the barriers are and try to work with them in regards to barriers. So.
Right. Well, we'll need to work with you as we're crafting this legislation, or, you know, with someone to, you know, to make sure that we're doing the best thing as far as the child support component of it.
And I will, certainly I'll be talking with Director Richardson again and sort of giving her some information as well.
Okay, great. Well, thank you all very much for coming.
Very much for having us.
Janet, for making this happen. Great. Mike Schmidt, are you still on the phone? Where are you?
Yes, Senator, I'm here.
All right, great. So this is going to be our last item. Just as we're looking forward, can other people put the phone on mute, please? We talked a while back about perhaps looking at some legislative fixes or expansions or funding requests or something with the short-term leave. And I wonder if you could speak to us about that.
Yeah, thanks, Senator. You know, I was actually thinking I'll keep this really brief, and maybe next time I'll have some more to report to you.
Great.
Because right now we are in the process of writing a report to the legislature and the governor on the program success and what, you know, obviously there are implications to the prison population if the program was to be expanded or not. And so we're putting that all into a report right now. So if it's okay with you, I think I will be there in person next time, and I can have a much better presentation for you and update everybody at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that will be that'll be perfect. And is this also, Mike, in the context of decisions about prisons and, you know, the number of beds and things? I've heard people talking to me about that we're up against.
Exactly right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we're at the tipping point
right.
for female offenders at Coffee Creek. They are over their capacity, and so the department is trying to figure out what their next steps are. And then, of course, the male population. We have a little bit of room to expand at this point because of the move they made to go into the medium facility out in Madras. But that's, you know, obviously something that we want to not expand into the next male facility either. So, yeah, it's all tied into prison expansion and bed.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's kind of playing out alongside that.
So there's a certain urgency around this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. All right, great. Okay, well, that's what we have for the agenda. Something I didn't do at the beginning that I should have was to formally welcome Brian to this group, although Brian is still here in an illegal capacity.
He's got an official name tag, though.
We consider him legal, but he hasn't received his formal appointment yet, but he will, and he's replacing Jeremy also works at Mercy Corps. Brian, why don't you just say something about what you do?
So I was previously a program manager for another reentry program, Bridges of Change, Multnomah County. Previously a mentor for them as well as a house manager and previously a client. I'm a product of reentry. I am the manager / navigator / office manager at the Mercy Corps Reentry Transition Center in Portland. Working with Multnomah County, providing supportive services for releases and some federal clients as well. Coming into a period of change there, but it's my position opened up because of longtime support and participation of Felton Howard. He's going into retirement, so I'm here to make his ride off into the sunset a little easier on his conscience and that it's in good hands and stewardship. So looking forward to an appointment to this task force and participation, and know that I go forth and share what we talk about and get input and feedback from our community.
I would like to also add that Brian was one of our first graduates of our REC program, Reentry Enhancement Coordination Program, about 5 or 6 years ago. And it's just great to see someone come full circle and now be such a big help to other folks coming out onto supervision. So glad to have him.
Very exciting.
Thank you, Charles.
Yeah, so welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
Okay, well, colleagues, with that, we are adjourned. We are adjourned.